We're going to start the meeting now, and it's being taped. I can almost hear myself talk. And this is the payment reform work group. This is going to be, I think, very similar to what we did in 2007 when we had five or six work groups, and we ended up coming out of that. And we also, at that time, had the Governor's Transformation Task Force, which came up with nearly identical recommendations to what the work groups for the Healthcare Access Commission came up with. And that led to the very significant healthcare reform bill that we passed in 2008 that I think got a lot of national attention. The Commonwealth Fund wrote a report on it, which was, I think we should have that passed out. Not today, but the only thing I didn't like about their report was they listed me as a key informant. And from my part of the state, that's not a compliment. So anyway, what I thought we could do is go around the room and introduce ourselves. And I'm Tom Huntley. I'm the co-chair of this task force. And so why don't we start and go around this way. And we'll start with Tony, actually, because he's okay. The other co-chair.
I'm State Senator Tony Laurie. I'm the other co-chair along with Tom here. So then we can...
I'm Kate Pruchet, Community Administrator for Health and Human Services Policy.
Jim Abler, State Representative Anoka in the City of Ramsey.
Julie Bunn, State Representative of 10 East Metro Communities along the St. Croix River.
I'm Matt Dean, Representative and Representative Bunn's neighbor to the north.
I'm Randy Chun with the House Research Department.
And I'm Meg Hasbrook, the Vice President of Contracting for Alina Hospitals and Clinics.
I'm Heidi Holstie, Associate State Director for Advocacy for AARP.
I'm Don Jacobs, Chairman and CEO of Hennepin Faculty Associates, large safety net practice in Hennepin County.
I'm Cindy Morrison, Vice President of Health Policy for Sanford Health.
Jim Prisabilla, Chief Executive Officer for Prime West Health in Alexandria.
Michael Scandrad here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition.
Julie Sonier, I'm Deputy Director of the State Health Access Data Assistance Center at the University of Minnesota.
I'm Dan Svensson, the Executive Director of Generations Healthcare Initiatives and HealthShare, Inc., both in Duluth.
I'm Jim Ryman. I'm representing Minnesota Medical Group Management Association.
I'm Jim Wilner. I'm the Vice President, Chief Financial Officer at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth.
Doug Wood, I'm a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic and chair of the Division of Healthcare Policy there.
I'm Jonathan Watson, Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers.
I'm Charlie Fazio. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Medica.
Ann Edwards. I'm the Chair of Pediatrics at Park Niclet Health Services.
I'm Mary Edwards. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy representing Terry Carroll. And no, we're not related. Didn't do it by design.
I'm Rick Wolstein. I'm Senator from District 17, which is Chisago County and Isanti and St. Francis in Anoka County. And I'm kind of living and breathing this. We just placed my folks in a nursing home in the last month. And so I'm living this every day. So I'm glad to be here.
I'm Kathy Sharon. I'm the senator from Senate District 23, which includes Mankato as part of the ISJ Mayo Health System, and all of Nicollet County, which houses North Mankato and St. Peter, and some of Sibley County, Winthrop and Gaylord. So I have rural interests in payment reform.
State Senator Dave Senjum, Rochester, represent Dodge and Olmsted counties.
Katie Kavanagh with the Office of Senate Counsel and Research.
Okay, well, let me just give a little, obviously everyone here knows about the Affordable Health Care Act and the options that we have. Amongst those things that were in that act were lots of pilot projects that were based on our 2008 bill. The medical homes, chronic disease management, all that kind of things are in that bill. I will say that in the 2008 bill, the three things that were recommended by both the Governor's Transformation Task Force and by the Healthcare Access Commission, the three things that weren't put into law were what we then called a level three or total cost of care, which is now morphed into accountable care organizations, and they are coming. Medicare is very interested in setting those up. So that, I think, is one of the biggest things we're going to have to do is the accountable care organizations. And anything else that you folks can come up with that you think will, if we change the payment, that we will get the kind of results that we want. And the other two things that we did not pass that were recommended were the individual mandate, which is in the federal law, and the exchange, which is basically, if we don't do one here, the feds will do it for us. And I think we know more about health insurance in Minnesota than the feds do. So we're going to have a lot of work. Our deadline for all the task forces is December 15th. So we want recommendations by December 15th, and they will then go to the Healthcare Access Commission, and the Healthcare Access Commission will have its deliberations and make recommendations to the House and the Senate starting next year. I will say I was at a National Conference of State Legislators meeting, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago, and the gentleman that started the Massachusetts Exchange was there talking, and he said, and this is just related to the exchange, not accountable care organizations, but he said, you better have the bill typed up and ready to go on January 1st because there's just so much that has to be done in that area. And I think certainly there's a lot of things that have to be done, and a lot of them are controversial. So that's why we have small providers, large providers, independent groups, all kinds of folks that are on this committee. So with that, we have some people. Oh, okay, let's see. Okay, we will get you a list, but oh, they already have it. Okay, of the pilot projects. Okay, it's in the packet. There's all kinds of pilot projects in the federal legislation, and some of those we probably want to do. Some of them we probably don't want to do. And you have a list of those in your packet. I will say I have not read the 3,000-page bill in its entirety. Don't intend to, so we will look at that. We will investigate waivers. There is a discussion going on with Medicare. Currently, Medicare and CMS, if you get a pilot project or a waiver in a particular geographic area, in general, you're not allowed to get another one in that geographic area, because they, but that is up in the air, and CMS has not decided whether they're going to continue that. And I'll just give you an example, this, and we'll hear about this in a little bit, but the state is applying for a advanced primary care program with the state. Well, Park Nicollet already had, I don't know if you finished yours yet, the Park Nicollet medical home kind of thing?
No, it's wrapping up. I mean, it's still in progress, but wrapping up.
And there's some counties in the southwestern part of the state that have some kind of a pilot project involving the Sanford system. And according to the strictest interpretations of what CMS has been doing, those particular geographic areas would not be allowed to participate in another. So we're going to have to get clarification on that for the pilot projects. The accountable care organizations are completely separate. They're not affected by this in any way. So if a state chooses to do an accountable care organization, that is not affected by any pilot projects that they might have or might want to have. Let's see here. should have brought that other map. Essentia Health gave me this map where there's some white states, and there's some light blue states, and there's some blue states, and then there's some dark blue states. And the white ones are the high quality, low cost. And it's Wisconsin, Minnesota, North, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa in this part of the country. And on the East Coast, it's Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire that are both high quality and low cost. And if you go down to where it was really dark blue, which is along the southern part of our country, my view is it's going to take them 30 years to catch up to where we are right now. And I don't want to have us have to wait for them to catch up with us. And that was my major goal when I went out to four times now to the White House, is to make sure that states that are already good don't get held back and have to wait for Mississippi and Alabama to catch up with us. And the understanding that I have, that is exactly what they're going to do. They're going to let states have a lot of flexibility and move in whatever direction they choose to do. So I think we can go further than most states are going to do. I guess I covered that. So that is, I think, where we are. And we have a number of people that are going to give us sort of an update on where the state is on some of the pilot projects and payment reforms that we've already enacted. So we're going to start with Jeff Schiff from the Department of Human Services and Carol Backstrom from the Department of Health. And feel free to ask some questions. You probably have to go through the chair, but if you have a question, get my attention, I'll call on you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It feels like the wrong season to be sitting here, but we'll improvise. My name is Jeff Schiff. I'm the medical director of the Department of Human Services, and it's a pleasure to speak to this group. I'm going to try to cover three gigantic areas in a relatively short period of time, and I'll tell you that I think a handout's being copied right now, and I apologize for it not being to you beforehand. I first think I'm just going to spend a couple of moments telling you about where the healthcare home program is in Minnesota, because it forms a framework for the first two parts of this. The 2008 legislation started the development of a healthcare home program, or continued it, I'd say, for folks in Minnesota in the public programs and those who are privately insured. Minnesota developed a rule with criteria for healthcare homes. I want to say a year ago, but it's not quite. It's really 6 months ago that rule came into being, and there was a work of a large collaborative group to talk about how we want practices to transform. And I want to emphasize that our goal here is to have practice transformation and to pay for it. So I think that that was the first thing that got done. The payment methodology that was developed by the Department of Human Services, along with a lot of input, was released in February and was approved by the by CMS in July last month for us to pay for patients in the healthcare home based on their level of complexity. Also, as part of payment methodology, certification is required to be paid, and practices have to recertify based on the results they produce. And then the third part of our program, which is really the part that we've sort of turned some focus to now, is about how we'll evaluate our outcomes for healthcare home. And the evaluation really follows the triple aim in terms of patient experience, quality outcomes, and then feedback of data around cost and utilization to the practices. And right now we're heavily into figuring out mechanisms to feedback data to practices about how they're utilizing services like emergency room, hospitalizations, pharmacy, and it's in some relatively actionable time frame. So we don't want to use 2008 data in 2010. We'd like to get practices information as timely a way as possible. So that's sort of the underpinning of what we're working on and where the community is. I said earlier this today, and I'll just say again, we just yesterday released a press release for the first 11 practices that are being certified through the Department of Health. There are approximately 100 practices that are lined up to be in various stages of certification. We estimate that there are about 700 primary care sites in Minnesota. So we have some good momentum going as far as that's concerned, and certainly a lot of interest. So that's sort of the baseline. The two things I'll talk about now from here that relate to healthcare home are the Medicare's multi-payer advanced primary care application. The Department of Human Services, Carol to my right, and her colleagues and my crew at the Department of Human Services just submitted this application on Monday for a Tuesday deadline. What this application allows us to do in Minnesota is it allows Medicare recipients who are in the fee-for-service aspect of Medicare to be paid in the same way that other folks are being paid in the state. So practices that have Medicare recipients could bill and get paid if they're certified healthcare homes the same way that practices will do for Medicaid and for some of their other payers as well. We estimate there are approximately 400,000 fee-for-service Medicare folks in the state of Minnesota, and our estimates on this demonstration needed to look at the rate in which practice would be certified and for program growth and the rate of enrollment, and we estimate that at the end of the demo, about approximately 220,000 Minnesota seniors would be cared for in the demonstration. The demonstration guidance lists that they will pay for that CMS will allow six states to move ahead in this mechanism. We don't know the number of states that are applying. We do know that there's a consortium of states that we've been involved in through the Milbank Fund, and that consortium of states is really looking at if funded, how can we actually analyze our data, our outcomes, and our results together so that we might be able to look and see whether Minnesota's program is working better or worse than other states such as Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, Pennsylvania, Colorado. I'm not sure if I'm missing others, but there's this there's that group from Milbank. Our application is in. We are proud of the hard work that went into our application, and it's available. But we never know how CMS will judge, so we will wait and see. The application also required that we estimate cost neutrality for the program, and we estimated based on our projections that we used for the Medicaid programs, we ran the same information for Medicare based on data we have, and we estimated a $14 per member per month cost to Medicare across the whole population for their recipients in our state, and we estimated savings that were greater than that in terms of cost neutrality. Almost all the savings, incidentally, had to be in Part A and Part B, so we couldn't use savings in Part D or in long-term care, and almost all of the savings came from hospitalization. Decreased hospitalization. The data was derived from best estimates of impactable conditions as well as estimates of folks in those conditions and what they would spend in hospitalization, and based on a literature review of what healthcare homes and coordinated care has done in the past. So I will take a breath here and tell you that's sort of the nutshell of what we have been doing for the last since the guidance was released in the beginning of June, so the last 2.5 months in terms of preparing that. Carol, I don't know if you have any other comments or if we have questions about that specifically.
Dr. Schiff, why don't you explain the fact that you have to have 50% of the people in an area in this kind of a program, which means it's not just Medicare and medical assistance. You've got to have probably even self-insured.
Thanks. The program, I'm going to go... I will let me by explaining it, let me just go back to say that some of the initiative for this program was from a governor's letter that came from a bunch of governors in New England who really asked for that. And in some of the smaller New England states, what they have done is they've actually gotten all the payers together in their smaller states, so they may be easier to get them together and say, we're all going to pay the same way. So one of the requirements was that they have that we have over 50% of the population served in this. Well, what we do in Minnesota is we take Medicaid, we take the state employees, we take those who are privately insured in Minnesota, and we get to a total, and that does not quite get us to 50%. And then we take those who are privately insured, who are self-insured in Minnesota from large employers or other self-insured programs, and we've estimated that we need a certain percentage of those folks, which is about 15% of our self-insured, or about 5% of the whole population, to be in this program in order to get to our 50% number to satisfy this application. We wrote the application. We were pretty specific that we needed to get to that, and we will get to, and our assumption is that through our efforts with other purchasers in the community, large employers, et cetera, we'll get to that by the end of the demonstration in 3 years.
Other questions? Okay, go ahead then.
Alrighty, so I'm going to go on to B. One of the parts of the PPACA legislation is the is that it allows states to apply for a state plan amendment such that Medicaid will. Federal Medicaid will pay 90% of the match for healthcare homes. And last year in the legislative session, there was some discussion about what the 90% related to, and we feel CMS is relatively clear that it's around planning for transitions of care, planning for care coordination, all of the medical home coordination services. CMS, there's obviously a lot in this legislation, and CMS has asked I think in probably a little bit of a unique way for CMS has asked for input from states and some of the nonprofits that we work with, like NASHBE, to give information to the states around, give information to the feds around how to set this up. And we were on a call with them last week to talk about how this 90% match should be structured. There are some specific things in the legislation that it calls for. It calls for programs to pay for care coordination for folks with specific chronic diseases, and it lists, I think, 6 or 7 chronic diseases, or patients who have specific levels of chronic conditions. So it says 1 chronic condition and risk for a second one, 2 chronic conditions, mental health conditions. So it has a bunch of a little bit of a menu of how to cover how folks would be eligible for this match. It lines up very, very closely with what we have in our program. And in our program, we start paying for care coordination when individuals have one major chronic disease that's defined as being ongoing, being of sufficient complexity, and needing a care team to be cared for. So we are trying to give CMS some guidance, some input on how they write the guidance for this. This is something that this legislature mandated us to apply for, and it's supposed to be out the beginning of it's supposed to start the beginning of 2011. So we would expect that some application for a state plan amendment around this would come up soon. On the call last week, there were about 400 lines, and 48 out of 50 states and New Zealand were represented. I was happy that they were there too. Anyhow, one of the things that I guess I want to say a couple things that I thought were interesting on this call. One is that one of the key things that all the states that are far along on this are doing is they're giving feedback back to their practices in as close to real time as possible. So Oklahoma, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, we're sort of probably a little more nascent in that work, but are really trying to figure out how we actually feedback information to our practices so they actually have actionable data with regard to that. So That's really what we know about that application right now. We're certainly tracking that and expect to track it. I think one other specific challenge around this for us is the 90% matches available for 8 quarters of fiscal years, and we're assuming we're going to start right away. One of the things I'll just say is that we will be spending perhaps more money on the care coordination later than we will earlier. So I just think that that's the reality is as more practices get certified, we'll spend more on practices. And I guess the last thing to say about both of these things is we have always assumed cost neutrality in these programs because we've assumed that the savings in both the state program and as we applied to the federal government for the Medicare participants would be realized elsewhere in the system. It's been really a transparent process with the providers and the purchasers that this is an expectation of this legislature. So I think so that is B, the 90% healthcare match. I'll stop again and ask if people have specific questions.
Yeah, Jeff, the 90% match, that is from the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
Right? And but the program itself is separate from the it's just something that Sebelius did separate from the healthcare right. reform.
The Medicare, I always have to look at the initials because I get them wrong otherwise. The multi-payer advanced primary care program is a mandate of the secretary, and she could do that because it is designed to be cost neutral. And the other one is from PPACA, the account Affordable Care Act.
And have you addressed the problem of the Southwest counties and the Park Nicollet pilot programs that they have? Or will they all be gone by the time this starts?
We have asked CMS to not count those. And we have worked with Park Nick very directly in saying that if they're still going, the care coordination payments that would be part of the care coordination would be figured into the total cost of care for the for their model. So the issue that CMS really has is about not double dipping. They don't want to pay for care coordination and then on top of that pay for a gain sharing that doesn't count that. So we've reassured them that we have mechanisms in place to avoid that. And in some respects, having our model where clinics actually enroll patients and bills for specific patients rather than give a global per member per month for a whole attributed model, it makes that a lot easier to do because then we can actually count the dollars that are going to care coordination in those practices.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
The last part of this is about accountable care organizations and gain-sharing demonstrations, and I have a handout that hopefully will get to you guys around this. I guess what we have the legislation that was passed here last session, the healthcare delivery systems demonstration project. And then I actually, we worked in our department to put together a grid that actually looked at those compared to several of the federal things in the federal legislation. And there's actually a few more of these that I'll touch on, but the ones that I think are most significant are the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation is really a infrastructure that's being set up. And you have a handout that I saw as part of this handout that lists the charges of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which is this one. I think it goes up to 18. It's quite a laundry list of opportunities to be tested and potentially used, and includes in that a lot of different payment models. So how that is set up is yet to be determined, but that center is funded for $1 billion a year. That $1 billion is actually not designed to pay for the primary care of patients who will be still billed through Medicare and Medicaid, but designed to sort of backstop innovation. The center is not required to be budget neutral, but it's allowed so that budget neutrality does not have to to start. And the center director, Tony Rogers, who is from Arizona, certainly sees accountable care organizations as a prime bit of work for his center going forward. But I think I don't think there's enough to say how those applications will come out right now. The Medicare Shared Savings Program is Section 3022 of the federal bill, and that's the section that instructs Medicare to develop a shared savings / accountable care organization model. And it is the section that specifically is not seen as a demonstration by the federal government, and hence when we have been asking the question of can we apply for the multi-payer advanced primary care and this Medicare shared savings program, the answer was yes, they don't compete with each other. And I think that's an important piece of information because we certainly don't want to hold up our innovation into an accountable care organization model if that's the way we want to go on the basis of a different demonstration. The federal government also has the pediatric ACO demonstration project, which is, I would say, also a little bit unformed, but authorizes a state to allow pediatric medical providers that meet specified requirements to be recognized as an accountable care organization. I think all of these, and then we have our own program, I think all of these really rely on, I would say, three crucial things. They require the right kind of payment methodology, they require the right kind of risk adjustment, and they require the right evaluation and our ability to evaluate them. And I think that I know because of discussions that I've been involved in Washington, and I think a lot of people in this room have, that there's a lot of work being done to figure out how to define those three things. You know, the payment methodology, the evaluation, and the risk adjustment. I think that the other thing I'd just like to say about the federal models and our model as we go forward is that the terminology around ACOs and gain sharing gets a little bit garbled. In some respects, the way one could look at this is, and probably the way I sometimes look at this is, we go from a payment for care coordination, which is medical home. The next step would be then some sort of payment for gain sharing, so that we share gain, and then how that gain gets defined and benchmarked against national averages or Minnesota averages or against the own institution is really a huge amount of work that still has to occur. And then the third one, which I think the ACO terminology is sometimes used for, is the sort of capitated model. And so what do you do at the end of that? Is capitation at the end of that for a whole system the way to go? I think there's some challenges around that, and I just want to I'm going to take this opportunity, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, to just say a couple things. One is I think we have to be careful about the right amount of incentive to providers, that if we go all the way to a capitated arrangement entirely, will this model stay family and patient-centered in that patients will see that their providers are their advocates, because we need our providers to both be our advocates and the stewards of our resources. So if a capitated model provides too much incentive to save money, is that how far we want to go? We have to be careful how far we drive that. And then the second thing I think that's really a little bit of a challenge in this in the ACO gain-sharing model is that there's separate roles for primary providers and for specialists. And the primary care providers have this role we've spoken a lot to. The specialist role is a little different. And if I can look at, if we look at Geisinger, which is one of the places that we talk about a lot in upstate Pennsylvania, Geisinger has both transformed their primary care role, but they've also sort of, for their specialists, have issued guarantees and started to talk about measuring the quality of their specialists' work and the cost effectiveness. So they actually have both things going. So they have really controls on quality and cost for their specialists, as well as controls on how they, the quality and the efficiency of their primary care providers. So I think as we go forward in this and we think about it, I think it's important to look at both of those aspects so that we create, if we do create an integrated delivery system that does both of these things, they can do both the specialty care and the primary care well. I think that's probably most of what I had to say. If I will be happy to take questions on this part or open up the conversation. So thanks. I think you now have my this handout so you can see. I'll just, if I can, I'll just break it down and say this is the general language I listed in the first column is actually the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and I extracted from the long list you have the ones that were of interest regarding payment reform. The next one was the applying entity, who could apply. The next, and I'm sorry, these are cut off on the bottom a little bit. The next is the entity qualifications and certification. Next is identification of patients, risk stratification, payment model, outcomes, and whether there's any funding and the duration of the project. So this is a guide that we produced internally, but I think it's a useful guide to sort of figure out how these things stack up against each other. So, thank you.
Are we going to have a test on this tomorrow?
I think it's now, isn't it? Pop quiz.
Okay, any questions? I don't see any, so why don't you continue on?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carol Backstrom, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health Reform at the Department of Health. And we were asked today to talk a little bit about our experience with the implementation of the baskets of care from the 2008 health reform law. And so what I thought I would do here is just go through some of what the process was and where we are today and some of the lessons learned with the implementation of this baskets of care concept. So first of all, as you may know, baskets of care is sort of a Minnesota unique term. It's also known as bundles of care, bundled payments, and episodes of care. I believe in the federal legislation, it's episode of care bundled payment pilot program in PPACA. So just to give you some context of the different terminology used of that used around that, this, of course, was part of the overall 2008 health reform package. And as you might remember, and for those work group members who weren't around for the debate during 2008 and the development of the health reform law, this is part of the overall package that includes that public health investment, the statewide health improvement program, or SHIP. We have some efforts around market transparency, of course, including the statewide quality reporting system and provider peer grouping. We have what we consider sort of the care redesign and payment reform concepts, which include the healthcare home model as well as the baskets of care model. And, of course, the supporting activities from 2008 that included, of course, the coverage expansion, some e-health initiatives, administrative simplification, and consumer engagement. So I just thought I would mention once again sort of that terminology of level three. In the sense that back in the time that the concept of baskets of care was being discussed, you might remember this was also in the context of having this level three payment system where providers would actually bundle a set of services in a basket and put out for bid what the basket included and what the price would be. And it was sort of tied in then again with the provider peer grouping system. Well, you might remember that that level three concept or that sort of that bundled payment system was not a part of the final legislation, but what we were left with still is this implementation of the provider peer grouping system and then implementation of the baskets of care. So in the legislation 2008, the statutory language required the Department of Health to establish uniform definitions focused on specific conditions, including diabetes, asthma, and depression, as well as cardiovascular care. As well as consider in considering which baskets to identify and to develop, consider the prevalence of health conditions, the treatment costs, and the potentials for innovation, and establish quality measurements that would be associated with each basket. And just important to note that in this legislation, you might remember that it was voluntary, totally voluntary on the part of providers to create a basket, and voluntary on the part of payers to pay for a basket of care. So through an RFP process, the Department of Health contracted with the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement and hired ICSI as our vendor to staff and facilitate the process where a steering committee would be pulled together, and that group in turn would name the subcommittees and identify all of the seven baskets of care to start out with. So those seven initial baskets that the steering committee identified included diabetes, adult and child preventive care, pediatric asthma, obstetric care, low back pain, and a total knee replacement. You might note here in choosing the types of baskets, the steering committee really tried to aim for sort of a sampling of both sort of chronic conditions, for example, a diabetes care package, which would probably need to be defined more by a time definition, like a year of diabetes care, versus an entire episode of care, for example, a total knee replacement that has a beginning and an end. And so they tried to come up with a variety, and I think one of the lessons learned is that there are certain types of services that lend themselves more easily to the basket concept, of course, than others. So in terms of the challenges, one of the things, well, let me just back up before I get into the challenges. So the steering committee and the seven subcommittees identified what the components of each of those baskets would be, defined what services were included, and also identified the outcomes measures for each of the baskets. And then that, in turn, went into rule with the state register process or our further codification of the state law that was into a rule that was published back in March of 2010. So as of that time, it was basically open season for any provider to go ahead and offer a basket of care, and in turn for any payer to consider entering into an agreement with a provider to pay for a basket. What I want to talk about in terms of the challenges and the opportunities is just to mention that, of course, we haven't had any providers register with the state in terms of offering a state-sponsored basket of care. But my overarching message that I want to leave you with is that I don't think this was a failed experiment by any means, by any terms. I think one of the great things that came out of this process overall were the fact that we, for the first time, and I think probably the only state in the country, actually bringing providers and payers to the table together to talk about some of the very real issues that come about when you're trying to offer an episode of care. So the fact that the federal legislation talks about, you know, wanting providers to offer episodes of care or baskets of care, I think what is not known at this point, or I think what we have a taste of in Minnesota, is how challenging this can be to put this together from an administrative and operational standpoint. And so this offered an opportunity for all of us to come together as a community to talk about those very real issues, which included, for example, billing. If the goal is to ultimately have all the sets of services into one bill, that's a very real hurdle in terms of how to make that scalable. Right now, if an entity, if a provider group wanted to offer a basket of care, it would be completely done manually, offline, out of the normal sort of billing and the billing process, just as it would be very offline or manual at the payer end in terms of having one claim for an entire set of services. So I think there's some real issues to work out in terms of how to scale up to what providers and payers can handle in terms of grouping sets of services together and the coding issues involved there, as well as how to group the sets of services. I think one of the other questions is sort of, you know, how do these baskets fit into a person's benefit structure? I mean, there's the whole issue around sort of co-pays or out-of-pocket expenses that are associated with multiple visits, and sort of how to have that put together in a benefit structure is a very real issue that will need to be discussed further as well as the contractual relationships. I mean, for an independent provider in rural Minnesota, it's a very different thing to think about offering a basket of care than it is for an integrated system, either in one of our larger metro areas or in other parts of the state. It's just a kind of a different story about sort of how do you offer sets of services provided by a variety of providers, perhaps who are not with the same system or employed by the same group. There's some issues there in terms of both regulatory and contractual issues that come up that would need to be worked out. The issue around data portability was identified as one of the administrative challenges. And, for example, what does happen when that patient is seeing multiple providers, and how does that information travel with the patient across multiple providers? And, of course, this issue around patient engagement, you know, patients needing to understand their out-of-pocket obligations, how to encourage patients. I mean, this is an opportunity to have that sort of shared decision-making process really come into play with patients in terms of really helping patients understand perhaps only to consume the services that they really need as opposed to, you know, having a number of services that aren't needed. But there's the potential for some confusion and backlash on the part of consumers or patients to think that, you know, the basket should have included more services when it doesn't, and how do you get patients to understand that, you know, there's some evidence, you know, based in the components of a certain package. I mean, there's just, it was a really interesting discussion, I think, for all the participants. And then, so just moving on, I just want to talk about some of the opportunities and definitely the upsides that did come out of this. And again, I'd say all in all, an excellent experience and very worthwhile in the sense that it really helped our community familiarize ourselves with the concept. And I would say with that, where we are now 2 years after the 2008 law passed and the conversations around baskets or global payments or episodes of care, we are tremendously further in having these conversations and the familiarity of the issues around these concepts than we were even 2 years ago. And that's what I think is one of the big wins or the one big takeaway from this experience. I think also that the steering committee and the subcommittees really offered a mechanism for discussions, really getting into more functional status measures as opposed to just sort of status, or I should say just process measures. So, for example, in the total knee replacement, you know, a more process measure would be around MRI usage. It would be something that, you know, one could track. But, you know, this is an opportunity to talk about sort of a set of services in the context of an outcome measure being more on number of days until you go back to work. So, I mean, that could be conceivable in terms of, and it did enter into the conversations when talking about outcomes measures, where we can really get it more into functional status measures. This is a really good mechanism for thinking about how we can fully build on the concept of learning collaboratives as well. I think, and again, this goes back to the point I made earlier, I think that more than anything, this conversation has really allowed the private sector to think about how they may want to group services together and put baskets or episodes together. And it wouldn't necessarily have had to be within the state-defined process. So the familiarity, again, around the issue of grouping services together, I think we're seeing play out very much so in the private sector with, you know, a number of the pilots that are going on between Fairview and Medica and Allina and Health Partners and Blue Cross. And there's just a lot of stuff going on in the community that I think grew out of this, not necessarily out of this process, but certainly the conversations around the possibility of grouping sets of services together. So with that, one other point that I just want to make is that, you know, so to help provide a little bit more context for your overall discussions in the coming weeks and months, one of the things that I really think is helpful is to think about the 2008 health reform sets of reforms and the components of that 2008 package is really being the building blocks for how we can think about further payment reform in the state. So medical home or healthcare home is a great building block into, you know, moving into, as Dr. Schiff talked about, some gain sharing or shared savings kinds of models. It certainly provides a framework for how providers can think about redesigning care and really making care more patient-centered, whereas baskets has offered us an opportunity to talk about entire episodes of care. We have provider peer grouping that's going to provide us just a ton of information in the market in terms of both cost and quality and how providers across the spectrum compare. And I think that kind of market transparency is going to be a really important building block for how we can talk about payment reform and how ACOs can consider how they want to. If there are provider groups that want to come together in an ACO kind of model, they could use the provider peer grouping system to provide information about cost and quality from a hospital inpatient standpoint and that kind of thing, who they might want to partner with and who's really good at what and who provides the highest value care in the state. So think of those 2008 components as really being those building blocks or that framework for how we can continue further payment reform and care redesign here in Minnesota. So with that, I'll stop, and I'm open for any questions.
Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Dean.
Did we in our bill ask you to do a patient review or a survey for what folks might want to know about cost, quality, bundling of services? Did we say go out and ask a bunch of patients what they want to know and how they want to receive that information, and did you do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I don't believe what you're asking was in the language specifically, although we did have a work group of consumers. There was some language around consumer engagement, and we pulled together a work group over the course of that first year that talked about market transparency and sort of, you know, what do people need to know to try to create those incentives to go to more, you know, higher value, high quality providers. There's a lot of consumer engagement work that's going on in the community already. And so we kind of limited ourselves in terms of what the language required us to do was just to pull together a group. And with that, we did sort of a horizon scan of all the different work that's going on from community from a community engagement standpoint. And we do have a report that's out, and it does talk very specifically about some of the observations that consumers are interested in terms of how to see information. And you might also be interested to know that we did pull together the employers, the employer representatives, and the consumer representatives from all of the subcommittees of the baskets work, because I think for a lot of consumers who are sitting around a table with a lot of providers and payers and talking about these concepts of, you know, episodes of care, I think that we wanted to provide an opportunity where the consumers could just come together and talk about sort of their observations in the creations of baskets and what they observed in terms of some of the hurdles and some of the, you know, the misconceptions about sort of what the baskets are and what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that was informative as well, and that those responses are also in that report, the legislative report.
The other questions? Don't see any. So thank you for your presentation, and next we're going to Vicki Kunerth. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Vicki Kunerth from the Department of Human Services, and my responsibilities are in the area of performance measurement and quality improvement. I've been asked to talk about pay for performance programs in our agency. And from Carol and Jeff, you've heard of new initiatives, new developing programs that are much more global. Well, I'm going to present sort of a taking a few steps back, sort of a historical information on where we started with initiatives around trying to affect quality and access to services. It's sort of, well, Carol said the baskets of care was level 3. Pay for performance, use of incentives and things like that are often considered a level 1 payment initiative. The Department of Human Services purchases healthcare for about 700,000 Minnesotans. And we have developed about 3 different categories of incentive programs. Our purpose in these incentive programs is to focus particularly managed care organizations to expand the utilization of preventive services and to improve chronic disease care. Our preventive service and screening services incentives have been operating since about 2001. And we pay managed care organizations when they expand services to children, measured by well child care, immunization, blood lead screening, mental health screening, developmental screenings, adults for breast cancer, cervical cancer, chlamydia, and we also have a comprehensive elder health evaluation. The amount of the incentive paid to health plans basically covers the cost of those additional services. Generally, when a service is expanded in managed care, it takes us about 2 years to have the actual capitation rates reflect that expansion. So this, in a sense, pays them for that expansion. The results are mixed. In no way the payment, as I said, it covers the expanded service. It does not cover any initiative around education or any kind of a campaign. We have had good improvements, particularly in well child services and blood lead screening, and immunization levels are quite good. The rest is sort of mixed. small incremental improvements over time. So that is what it is. A second sort of category of incentives we use is a negative incentive. It is a withhold that is was authorized and required by legislation. Of the withhold, we determine a capitation payments to managed care organizations, and then relative to performance, that's 5% of their capitation payments are withheld, and we return it to the health plans about 18 months later based on their performance. The current withhold performance targets include some admin measures, some data measures, some audit results, and one clinical measure, blood lead screening. And in this next contract, we will be adding another measure to require a reduction in emergency department usage. And so there'll be two clinical related measures. As I mentioned before, the blood lead screening has improved. It's improved very dramatically. We have set a goal of 80%. And three of the eight health plans have reached that 80% goal, which is substantial. When you think of blood lead screening, which is the federal standard, when you're thinking of drawing blood from an infant and a toddler, nobody in the room is happy, you know. So for the health plans to achieve 80%, that is very substantial achievement. The third category of incentives that we participate in, and I think this is our strongest incentive, in 07, again, with legislative authorization, we joined with private purchasers and Doer in working together with Bridges to Excellence to reward for optimal chronic disease care for specific diagnoses, for example, diabetes and cardiovascular care. And this was unique partly because a Medicaid agency, we were the first in the nation, pooled incentive dollars with private sector so that there is a across the marketplace, you know, joint project of communication. But it is a reward based on actual clinical results rather than just an access to a discrete service. It was somewhat of a struggle. Jeff described his getting his payments for healthcare homes from CMS. This one was a tough one. CMS does not approve for clinical results. They generally approve spending money for services, but we did it. And there has been some improvement in our area. In the last 3 years for optimal diabetic care, we have about doubled the rate of public clients who are receiving optimal clinical results. So that is probably, although it's a very small share of our population, whether in the private sector or for our clients, that is probably our strongest incentive program. But it raises the issue that I know you're all struggling with, because it is a single diagnosis. And it doesn't, in the long run, probably doesn't make sense. Well, I think what's my personal view is that it's much more important to invest in the total care or total chronic disease care management, such as, you know, the healthcare home model and other models that you're considering. But this is where we started in our public programs. And I can provide more details on the dollars and whatever. One thing I didn't say before, for the preventive services, for example, in this past year, we paid the health plans nearly $800,000 for expansion across all those dozen or so measures. So it is not a large amount of money trying to leverage improvements.
Well, let me just comment on something you said about this state trying to combine the private sector with just public programs. And in the last couple of years, going around various national meetings, it's amazed me how few states have tried to do that. They will talk about doing something in medical assistance, and they never talk about doing something in the private sector. And the whole point, it seems to me, is you have to have a critical mass. If you want providers to change what they're doing, you have to have a critical mass of their patients enrolled in some kind of program, and that's in the past, as a state, we've had to worry about medical assistance, and now we're getting the opportunity to worry about Medicare, which we never had to be concerned about in the past from the state point of view, and that's back up to the advanced primary care application, where you need half of the people in a geographic area involved in that kind of a program, and you can't do it with just medical assistance and Medicare. So you have to have the private sector involved, and I think that's a lot of what we did in the 2008 bill was, I will say we got a lot of support from the Governor's Transformation Task Force, and I'll never forget Charlie Montreal and Tom Forsythe in the final meeting saying, well, I hope the state does this. And it's a good thing for the state to do, but as self-insured, we're going to go ahead and do it anyway, no matter what you do. So we have that involvement in this state, and it is a tremendous asset that I don't think occurs anyplace else in the country. So any questions? Yeah, Representative Bunn.
Thank you. Ms. Penderth, two questions. One on the withholds. Where are we and what's somewhat the trend or the last few years of data in terms of how much ultimately the 5% is actually paid back in the withhold process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I can send the committee the specific details. Generally, the majority of the money is returned because they meet the requirements or meet their incremental goal. Like for blood lead screening, every year they have to achieve 10% of the gap. And the majority do. It varies from one to maybe three health plans miss on one or two elements and so lose maybe 1% of their capitation and don't get the majority returned.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. A second question then tying the two together on the Bridges for Excellence, and you mentioned specifically the diabetics receiving optimal clinical care. I recall when we originally received the data for that program, it's only about 6% in the state receiving optimal care, and I think so doubling is maybe edging up to 20 if we're really optimistic, a tripling or what so. In either that program or the withhold, has the department done any very serious analysis of whether or not these approaches may be more workable or would possibly achieve greater results if there was a stronger incentive involved? Either we don't have enough money involved in the system or it's too easy to meet the requirement or the performance benefit is not high enough for them to really put a lot of resources into achieving it. So how much analysis do we have on the effectiveness of these?
We've had some conversations with researchers to measure that very thing, and we're in the process of having those discussions with researchers who might do some of that analysis. We've basically watched the literature that raises the issues of not only the financial amount of it, but other features. I mean, I think that some of the power and effectiveness of incentive programs has as much to do with the profile and the marketplace working together as it is the amount of money that is paid. I think we see that in the Bridges to Excellence initiative, where there is a lot of power and energy behind the fact that certain clinics are recognized and acknowledged for their improvements in care of their patients. But we don't have a specific analysis for the effectiveness of our incentive programs.
I just comment on that. I think we have community measurement, which I think is probably more important than the financial incentives. And it's personal, but after 40 years of teaching medical students, they're all extremely bright. They're all very hardworking. They're almost all very dedicated and empathetic to their patients, but they are also extremely competitive, and they've never been out of the top 10 in anything in their life. And when the clinic down the street gets a higher rating than they do, things will change. And it's not the patients changing, it's the providers changing what they do. So I think that's a powerful incentive. And again, there aren't many states that have a community measurement program that actually publishes this data. Dr. Jacobs.
Representative Huntley, I want to pile on that a little bit and ask if we have any incentive programs in place where we're trying to incentivize the patients in some way as opposed to the providers. And the other part of the question is all of our incentive paid back with a withhold, or is there actually an incentive that is new money in the programs?
Mr. Chair, we do not currently have a patient incentive program. Different health plans have individual ones from their own initiative, but the department doesn't have one generally. The incentives for the preventive services are new money, and the incentives paid through Bridges to Excellence pooled with the private sector is new money. So that's real money provided to the health plans or to the clinics in the case of the Bridges to Excellence. But as I said, I can provide details on what specific share of the withhold, you know, has not been returned to the health plans.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Kuhnarth? I don't see any, so I'll thank you for your testimony. Now we're going to go into the brainstorming session. I know some of you are providers and other are insurance companies. And I thought maybe we could go around the room and just have people discuss any innovative things that they're doing in their particular area that would fit in, and maybe if the whole state did it, that we could get some cost savings in the system. So I don't know who wants to start first. Dr. Wood.
So there are sort of several levels of things that we have done or are doing at Mayo. From the perspective of episode-based payment, we actually have used episode-based payment for large surgical procedures going back to the 1990s. And there's been a pretty big interest on the part of our large buyers, and it includes things as complex as transplant. And those have actually worked very well. In 2002, we did a project in our own primary care delivery effort and tried to modify our benefit system to match that. And that goal was to encourage every Mayo employee to have a personal physician and to use their primary care physician as their primary source of contact and information, rather than the prior system we had, which favored having our own employees seek care from our specialty physicians. And in particular, on the benefits side, what we did was to eliminate all copays for primary care visits, as well as any other preventive services. We never actually had copays before. We had first dollar coverage. That's one of those interesting things about the Mayo system. But we put in high copays for specialty care. We didn't create a gatekeeper system, so we allowed free access to specialty care, but just said to the employees, if you want to go to specialty care first, you can do that, but it will cost you. And we put in similar copays for complex imaging lab and emergency room services. The results of that were obvious within a year, with about a 20% reduction in spending for specialty care, imaging, lab use, an increase in primary care visits, and our total spending also fell fairly significantly. The other thing that we did for the primary care physicians is we changed their measurement system. Everybody at Mayo is salaried, but we changed the accounting system to in primary care from one that looked at how many visits you did to how many patients you served. So the challenge for the primary care provider teams was reorganize away from physician-based delivery to team-based delivery and serve more patients per team, that is, increase your panel size to become more efficient. We ultimately have also then participated in other projects like the Diamond Project, and we are working on a project we call High Value Healthcare with Dartmouth and Intermountain Healthcare, in which we are encouraging the primary care physicians to deliver guideline-based care for patients with one or more of seven chronic conditions on a consistent basis, and then our goal is to see what the cost structure of the diseases happens to be after we've done this approach. So rather than saying to the providers, we're going to pay you a bonus, since we don't do that at Mayo, we simply said we expect you to do your job as providers and provide guideline-based care, and our assumption is that that will result in an improvement in overall spending. Now, we're just in the analysis phase of that now. Last year, calendar year, was the year of actual implementation, so I don't have any data yet to tell you what the impact has been. We're also working on an accountable care community project in Austin, Minnesota. There's been some, I think, interesting research there in terms of the emphasis of measurement, and we are doing some fairly intense work in terms of seeing what opportunities are in front of us for the federal reform law in terms of Center for Innovation options in CMS and accountable care organizations, among other things. So that's what we're working on.
Okay, Representative Huntley, I'm Mary Edwards, and try to summarize as well as Doug, you just did. We just had the luxury of meeting with Tony Rogers last week and tried to walk through with him what we're doing at Fairview and what we've done with Medica and Blue Cross and other payers and other providers, trying to figure out that thriving in a fee-for-service model while transforming to a value-based model is really where you're headed. If you've talked to my CEO lately or if you've talked to Terry Carroll, you know that we're not trying to sit still anymore. We're trying to create new value, realizing new economic value of new models of care, and trying to do cultural transformation. I think, Representative Huntley, you said it very well. Physicians are very competitive, and when you help them compete in a different way and try to do a different panel size, life changes very dramatically. And you have to enable a new business model is really what we have to look at. And so we're really trying to figure out how to do physician alignment and integration. When we were talking about Geisinger just a few minutes ago, they're a very unique model. They're all own physicians, and that's not the way Fairview is, and that's not the way my friends across the aisle with Allina is either, and how do we do this differently, or my friends here at Park Nicollet are or aren't. And it's so we're in a very unique situation here at Fairview, but here in the state of Minnesota, and how we can make this work, because if it can work in the state of Minnesota, it can work across the country. And we have a complete sense of urgency to be an ACO by 2012. We're in a unique position that we want to think about it from a adult population as well as from a pediatric population. We had the same sense that Dr. Schiff had, is that as you meet with CMS, clearly they're working hard on what to do in Jonathan Bloom's area from the ACO angle, but from the pediatric area, they're still trying to figure that all out. I mean, this legislation just passed in March, so it's fairly new. From an actual perspective of what Fairview has been able to accomplish in the last year and a half very quickly, you may have heard about some of the things we've done within our clinical areas, that we've transformed our clinical operations in four clinics at this particular time. We took away the payment system that we had with RBUs and said we're going to totally transform the care and the payment, and we're going to do it differently. What we were finding is that our physicians were taking 90 minutes of backpack work home per night. What I mean by that is everything always went back to the physician, every email, every lab result, everything, which is just the wrong way to do care. We said
let's figure out a completely different way to do this. And what we created were teams, teamlets, or not to use a football term, but that's basically what we did, and that we create huddles every day that we're actually finding that the receptionist, the lab person, the nurse practitioner, the physician actually work as a team, and they meet multiple times during the day in a team grouping. And it has totally transformed the way we're delivering care within these clinics. We anticipate by the end of this year, all 48 of our clinics across the state of Minnesota, we will have changed the way we're delivering care in of all of our clinics. And it's really been exciting work. I'm sorry that I'm not Terry, because he could articulate it a lot better than I can and with greater enthusiasm, but it's absolutely, in the 15 years I've worked for Fairview, it is spectacular where we're headed, where we're going, where we want to be. The other thing is Carol articulated, I thought, very well in talking about care packages. We've already developed 12 care packages. I can give you the list right here, and we're working to do more. It is difficult, and I thought Ms. Backstrom said a great thing in that as you think about how to do it when you're talking about patients that are usually quite complex. We deal with that every day, that if you have diabetes, you typically have congestive heart failure as well. And so how do you break down a care package appropriately and make it workable? And how do you measure it over time? And what are you really evaluating for and how this is going to work? The other interesting thing that we've just are still in the middle of our evaluation process, but it's been fascinating to observe, is our virtual care that we've done with Blue Cross Blue Shield. We literally have great data that has shown that we had all the, I think I can say this publicly, and we just shared it with Tony, but we had all the employees of Blue Cross Blue Shield that we had, they had the luxury of calling into physicians, I believe it was from 8 to 6, Monday through Friday, and then part of Saturday and Sunday. And what we, the real key of what we were trying to see is how much time were we saving Blue Cross Blue Shield by not having them physically go in for a physician visit. And it was absolutely, our data is still new, but absolutely astounding as to how much time we saved them and the dollar amount that we saved them by doing virtual care and what people called in for that you could actually do that way and really do it through, might be an easy way to look at it, is through telemedicine. So those are some of the four quickies that I can give you at this point. And I can probably share some of the summary that we gave to Tony in a document to you. I can't do it at this particular time, but I will get it to this group before your next meeting. So I think would be helpful for what we're doing at this particular juncture.
And so you're going to move what you were doing with the
Egan
team
clinic
approach into every one of your clinics in the state?
That's our goal.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Representative Huntley, Chair Huntley. An observation, too, as we embark on this brainstorming session, I'd like to expand it a little bit, too, because a lot of the concepts that I'm hearing are actually supposed to be integrated into our healthcare home model. And so one of the things that we really need to be cognizant of is making sure that our existing healthcare reforms are supported and are accessible to the broadest cross-section of our entire healthcare community that's out there today. So it's not, restrain yourself to new payment reform ideas. Help us also think about how we make sure that our existing provider network, particularly, you know, I think that we're probably going to see a bit of reluctance from some of the small providers to being able to step forward and enter our healthcare home model, and I'd really like to figure out how to look at those barriers and take those down and make them an active participant in this as well. So just to add to the brainstorming, because these are really critical aspects, the making sure everyone's working at the top of their license, the team approach, the interdisciplinary approach, the greater reliance on primary care and expanding treatment options and communication options, bringing the patient at the center. I mean, these are all integral concepts to the healthcare homes that was a key component to our 2008 reform. So as we brainstorm, you know, just try to expand it is something I'm going to be working on as well.
Representative Huntley, Senator Lori, one additional comment that I think is important to mention that is real key as we move forward
is the ability to integrate. And I think the state, you two in particular, I'm looking at, and those of you that serve as state representatives, the ability to talk to one another electronically in the future is going to be critical as we move forward, and that we're not slowed down in that way. And sharing of patient information is going to be a critical component, and especially as you look out in greater Minnesota, that if my mother's going to Mayo, which is a possibility, frankly, she's not that much further away than she's than being up here, that information is translated up here as if she were to do a surgery here. That is critical as we move forward, and will reduce costs tremendously. And so that's been an important area that you as a body, two bodies, have been very active and involved with.
Tony was the co-chair of the task force that dealt with the medical home,
mm-hmm.
along with Aaron Murphy.
And we've been working on, with Tom and everybody, the electronic medical records, the e-health initiatives as well. And I think Minnesota, the feds have actually been looking to Minnesota for a lot of the models that they use. And so it's another resource that we have available to us, and we need to include that as a component and utilize that resource to the greatest benefit for our people and our providers. Yeah.
Dr. Wood.
So I might ask actually a question if I'm thinking about what Senator LaRue is suggesting. As the Department of Health and Department of Health and Human Services are actually out surveying practices in their applications for medical home, whatever, if Carol or Jeff, if we could get some information from them about where practices are not actually meeting the criteria. That might be really helpful for us in terms of making some suggestions about what can be done. When our practice in Austin was reviewed, the one criterion that we were actually had the most difficulty with was a registry. Mm-hmm. And so we might need to think about how we could devote more resources to support the smaller practices that can't afford to have their own registry. And there may be some others that we can learn from in the certification process. So I don't know if we have, well, we've only probably done 20 visits or something like that, site visits or so. It might be a little premature, but there are, as Jeff said, there are a lot on the docket, so that's another data source we might use.
There was a pile of money that came with the stimulus package, mm-hmm. to help smaller clinics set up electronic medical records. And I think there's more for the FQHCs than the current bill.
Where is
that? So, Carol Backstrom, did you have some comment on the implementation of medical homes and the requirement for medical records?
Mr. Chair and members of the work group, I believe that we can actually provide some input on sort of what the deficiencies might be, if there are trends coming out amongst, you know, during the site visits and during the application process. To your point around EMR or the use of the EMR in the health care home spectrum, you know, the certification standards for Minnesota's version of the health care home requires the registry, but it doesn't necessarily need to be embedded within an EMR. We were trying to acknowledge, in fact, that there are certainly practices that could become healthcare homes without having an EMR up and running. And so the registry, the patient registry, could actually be, you know, as simple as a Excel spreadsheet or other types of ways to track patients, the important part being that those healthcare home patients were tracked in a consistent and standardized kind of way along with a care plan. I think that is one big difference around our Minnesota standards for healthcare home than, say, NCQA, which has a much heavier emphasis on the use of EMR and electronic health records to support medical home.
Let me ask a follow-up question. I mean, that's a huge controversial issue. Should Minnesota have its own rules on medical homes, or should we just do what the feds do so that our providers don't get stuck with having the two systems that they have to deal with? Has that been resolved yet?
Mr. Chair, I think the certification standards process, the development of the certification standards in Minnesota, I think providers and payers appreciated the opportunity to come up with a Minnesota-specific set of standards of certification because they're a little bit more flexible, arguably flexible than, say, the NCQA standards. Having said that, you know, we hear, you know, the whole spectrum of concerns and issues from, you know, anywhere from the certification standards are too stringent to, you know, that they're not stringent enough and that sort of thing. I think what will be interesting is if Medicare does, you know, choose Minnesota as a site to participate in the Advanced Primary Care Demonstration Project, that will further, I think, solidify our payment methodology approach. And I think that's a huge incentive for Minnesota providers to go with the Minnesota certification standards compared to, you know, other parts of the country or the NCQA standards, for example, because it's going to be used for Minnesota payers. So obviously that's a pretty big incentive to consider those standards of certification.
Other questions? Mr. Watson.
Just to add on that healthcare home, one of the frustrations for the federally qualified health centers is also the 24/7 coverage, and just some of the smaller, particularly greater Minnesota health centers having troubles with that requirement. However, just to ask you a question, Ms. Backstrom, in terms of how many of the existing 100 or however many in the pipeline have received a variance in that whole process? If you have any data on that, because I think community health centers and other providers are interested, but we're just a little unclear on that variance process and if it's doable for certain things and what the procedures are. So,
Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, this initial set, I don't believe any of them had a variance or requested a variance. I could be wrong on that. Okay. So, but I do think over time you'll see some evidence of those entities that do have variances. And I think as more and more come on board, that will be more of something to explore, and you'll be a lot more, I think we'll all be a little bit more familiar with what that process will be.
I haven't seen the paper yet today, but the 11 that were selected, are those from large delivery systems or?
Mixed, I think.
Was it one guy?
Okay. Oh, well, you've got my favorite place, Staples.
Mr. Chair, as
you can see, I had a medical home before I had ever heard of the term.
Mr. Chair, as you can tell from the news release, it is really kind of a variety of types of providers, and the other good news part of that is that it's really across the state. It's pretty geographically spread out at this point.
And the Staples one is, I mean, they have their own clinics, but they're not part of any bigger system. They're basically independent. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I just can't help piling on now with this, one of my new favorite topics to talk about, helping the Watsons of the world to and Scandrets to serve in the healthcare home thing. And actually, I have 2 points I want to make that are related to our conversation, but this kind of feeds into one of them. If you get this distribution of all these healthcare homes and fail to get the population that these people serve, they're not going to go to fancy places. They don't frequent those places. And so in the name of accountability and standards and quality and all these things we love, we risk carving out these places that are the epitome of access and quality and accountability and frugality. They don't have the money to do the paperwork to show how good they are. And I've thought all along that we, at our peril, that we risk all the good ideas, all the standards, and so on. That just and so, Mr. Chair, there's the point I wanted to make about our not to forget that we don't want to forget our low tech successes. That's just my segue out of you guys, so you're on your own again. But in my world, where I live in a very conservative healthcare arena, my work is decidedly low-tech and in chiropractic and in natural healthcare stuff. And it's amazing how many people benefit by drinking water and eating vegetables and walking and getting their spine balanced. And they come to me at the end. They've already spent $10,000 or, and the insurances have gladly paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 of all kinds of stuff. And for $300, they're way better. And they question my $300.
All right, I'm not complaining about that, but I'm pointing out to you all who are here in payment reform, maybe we should not forget that sometimes the simplest answers still work pretty well. And as we, you know, the idea about the phone call, like, wow, who would have thought of that? Well, that's really smart. You know, they work. And so sometimes, and we need to innovate and have new drug regimens and new surgeries to solve new problems. But at the end, if we've neglected some of the more fundamental things, we are going to spend a ton of money pouring healthcare into people to no end, to no benefit, except that they're going to be very high-cost people with continuing multiple chronic conditions. And so the one thing is I want to remind you about low-tech and conservative care and some things that alternative that some – and there's politics around alternatives. Oh, I just don't believe in that. Well, fine, don't believe in it. But people pay cash for a lot of alternatives because they actually work. They don't get coverage. And if there's a way to roll that into the system, they might go there earlier. And there's a piece about that. So low-tech is a thought there. And the second thing with Ms. Kunerth, who was here talking about these incentives, I want to remind you, from my 31 years as a provider, I have met hundreds of people who do my work and other kinds of clinical work. And there's three categories of kind of motivations internally. The one you like is like the Peace Corps doctor kind of guy. And he just loves to work, and if he can get food, he's happy, you know, or she. You know, and there aren't enough of those in the health systems to, that would be great, wouldn't it? They can work at the Mayo for food. But then you have kind of the sensible provider, that's the next group, who you pay them and they appreciate, you know, and they're, all this reform you put on them just kind of aggravates them because they're already doing pretty sensible work. When you manage them heavily, you save 5% because they just wasted a test once. But and then you have the people at the top of the spectrum that understand they're peace workers. And they got it figured out on all the things you're going to decide here. They're going to find a way around to get more pieces. If it's more baskets, if it's more, you know, just a new way to treat the same person. And so as you give incentives, and if you punish the Peace Corps guys, like, what, you know? They don't, and or if you give them an incentive, it's like they're driven by a passion for people. The sensible people are already doing pretty sensible work, so I just want to caution us against punishments and incentives to the wrong group of people, because you won't get the results you think. You'll spend a ton of money on some incentive on a sensible provider, and he's already going to do the stuff anyway, or she'll be really good at what they do, because they actually are sensible, and they just don't want to be, and the thing about the competition might actually work with them just to kind of score them, but that's free. And these, but the where the money is, I'm convinced, is the top 10, 20% of the utilizers on per patient stuff that you need to tell them they can't do that. And find ways to go after that and help them become sensible, either by giving them a different career or getting them out of your network or just helping them be educated. And I think that's the second piece I wanted to bring forward, which I think is productive. So I'll just tell you that a $2 benefit doesn't motivate me to work harder. I'm on the platinum tier of whatever group I'm in because I'm kind of high. I get bored with the same people. And if they get better, I say, well, you're getting better, so why don't you come back, you know, in a longer interval? And there's no reward for that in the system. Chair Huntley talks forever about St. Mary's as they do their better health, their heart work, they lose money. People like me actually go broke in the fee-for-service system because we don't have the volumes because we're actually sensible about it. So, but that's really important, and I think all of you who were in systems know what I'm saying, and so we can't lose those two parts as we try to solve this. And so the low-tech thing and remembering what kind of providers you got, so I hope that's productive.
Thank you. Dr. Wood, you had a comment?
I just wanted to follow on the issue of where we might have to be cognizant of sort of national requirements and local requirements. So one of the next things will happen for providers is in the context of electronic record implementation and the meaningful use regulation that was just written actually has some implications for us in Minnesota. For example, if you look at the meaningful use criteria for diabetes, they're actually different than Minnesota Community Measurement. And so I am waiting for Jim Chase to call me back, but we're beginning to confront this in southeastern Minnesota in the Beacon Project we're doing by using electronic systems to link schools, public health departments, and medical practices together, we will only want them to measure their performance one way. We don't want them to duplicate, so we have to kind of decide what it is we want to do. So we may have to think about some trade-offs. That will just be one of the practical implications of what we do.
Other comments from anybody? Oh, Representative Bunn.
Just a comment along the lines of concern about impact on the low-tech guys or other kinds of things, but concerns about unintended consequences as we go forward with these kinds of models. I've heard specifically from some subgroups and many small practitioner groups, whether they're both primary care clinics or side groups of private physical therapy groups, those kinds of things, concerns that depending on the different kinds of pay-for-performance systems or the different kinds of payment models, if ACOs or other things, that you're moving towards greater concentration, less ability of the small clinics to survive, you know, fewer choices for consumers, all kinds of things like that. And I think that really is a big very real possibility. I think it may be already occurring. And I would be interested in having this committee in one of these many meetings that are on our schedule have that topic specifically on the agenda, try to find some economic research or experts who know something about the possible consequences of moving down these various tracks, and also bring in some of those kinds of provider groups that and independent groups who have these concerns, because they may have already specific comments about what they see taking place already or what they fear will take place specifically in this process. So I just want us to be aware of that. And I see what's going on in the dental area as well, and some of the changes we've had from the state government against pushing out, you know, private providers, things like that. So to be cognizant of how we're impacting the various business models and the scale that we are encouraging or discouraging in the system.
Other comments? Yes.
Kind of listening to the discussion, and especially since it's transitioned a little bit into talking about alternative or unintended consequences, a lot of the work that I've done, and certainly Park Nicollet embraces this greatly, is a healthcare home, and I would call us early adopters. But as part of that, it's really that truly meaningful patient-family-centered involvement, and what that means is an equal team member. And in these discussions and when we think about things, I think that that resonates when we think about unintended consequences, or are we really doing something that's going to be meaningful for the very individuals whom we're trying to, as a whole, improve their health. So just another comment as well.
I was talking to one individual this morning who talked to me a couple of weeks ago, and he's very concerned that we did not reactivate the continuum of care task force, which sort of addresses what you're talking about. There's all sorts of interactions. And we certainly saw it in the GAMC fight that you can't separate social services for these people from their health care. They don't have a place to sleep. They're not going to be taking their meds.
Right. Right, and yeah, they're our conscience.
Other comments? See any? There she is. Okay.
As Align is moving in its journey from pay for volume to pay for value, you know, we are doing many pilots in case management fees and for, you know, the medical home, and also in moving to shared savings on total cost of care projects with various payers in the community. And one of the obstacles we're running up against is who owns the data. You really need the claims data to be able to target innovative approaches to reducing the total cost of care. And one of the things I wanted to mention, too, is that we're not just looking at the total cost of care and the affordability aspect, but also including the patient experience in that measure and the quality of care. And I think that's really important for us to make sure that we're looking at all three of those as we develop an approach here, the triple aim. But you know, we've had many outside organizations come forward too to say we want to be your data referee, so we'll be between you and the payer, and we'll own the data for you, and of course charge both of you more than you're already paying. So I think it's really important that we think about the information, and not just the EMR, but the claims information and how that gets in the hands of the provider, who can probably do most with targeting the efforts in terms of both care improvement and cost.
Dr. Fazio.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's still in the vein of things going on in the community and maybe a little payer perspective on some of the things we've heard. We're in our fourth year of paying for medical home experiments, pilots, projects, and I think our evaluations are consistent with what you heard earlier, especially when the health plan backs away, as we ought to, at the point where the patient has a medical home. They don't need outreach by both the health plan and the provider group. So it's been essential for us to design our systems so that we know who's in a medical home and who isn't, so we can continue to do outreach to those that don't have a medical home yet, but we can leave those people alone who do have a medical home. And our evaluations support what Dr. Schiff said earlier, is that the biggest gains from a medical cost perspective are in emergency room and hospitalization costs, but there's also greater satisfaction with provider outreach than there is generally with health plan outreach. I don't think anybody's surprised by that, especially in the current climate regarding health plans. We're in our third year of total cost of care projects, and those similarly have involved a change in how the health plan behaves. We become much more of a source of information, as Meg was saying, when you get into an evaluation in a situation where it's total cost of care. How much can we tell a practice about the people in our health plan that we think get their care in that practice so that their care can be enhanced, so that their care can be more informed? So that's become a critical role. I think
it
links.
Do you risk adjust then for your medical groups that are participating?
Mr. Chair, when we do cost comparisons and when we work on incentive goals, we do risk adjustments and various targets that we negotiate with a given group. But yes, all of these costs are risk adjusted, and the relationships only start, I would think, after a lengthy period of courtship, getting to trust one another's information. And we've gotten better at anticipating what that information might be and providing that information as we go into these relationships. I think this also ties into Carol's earlier remarks about baskets of care not having been embraced early on. That's a very difficult concept for a consumer to get hold of. It's a hard concept to administer, as she described, from a benefits point of view. And it just sort of sits out there almost as an orphaned concept in the absence of total cost of care. But when you get to total cost of care, the provider, interestingly, has an interest in baskets of care. We're getting requests now from providers who are in total cost of care arrangements asking if we'd be willing to tell them who we think the most efficient specialists are in a given area of specialty, which is exactly what we said in 2007 would happen, that at the point where I'm interested in the outcomes of a particular population of people, I become more interested in the care they get when they leave my office. And so the work that's being done in provider peer grouping, the work that we can do individually to help identify those providers who have both quality and efficiency in what they do, has become a huge part of what we do now as we move out of doing some of the formal outreach ourselves. We've tried to change also some of the other healthcare processes that traditionally have occurred at the health plan. So you think of something like a care manager or a health coach. Again, normally these things happen at the health plan. If there isn't a health coach, if there isn't a healthcare home, we have a couple of trials going on right now where we have moved some of these people into the delivery system, some of those in community clinics too, so that we can see, is this more effective when it's a health plan representative but they're out there with part of the care team, as yet another transition into more and more of this happening into the care team.
In the let me just ask, show my ignorance. In the fee-for-service system, diabetic education, is anybody pay for that, or do clinics just do it?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head when, where, or how much, under what circumstances, for which employer groups we pay for that. I think Doug's answer was it varies, and I think it does. But I Representative Abler earlier talked about incentives. I mean, if we take away the need to have a visit as the way somebody gets paid and the only way that somebody supposedly gets care, I think we dramatically change the way that you can provide care. And I think healthcare home was the first way to do that, so you could remove the need for somebody to come in who had a chronic disease. I think total cost of care takes a massive move away from that and says, what if we were just interested in having people who are as healthy as they can be at this point in life, whatever point they happen to be, and then help you gain a reward if you're efficient at doing that? I mean, and that's the conversation I think that's happening more and more in the community.
Julie.
I wanted to echo some of what Charlie was saying about the provider peer grouping and its potential. I think this also ties into some of Meg's issues about the data. So back in 2008, although there wasn't any agreement on a total cost of care model, what we did get was the creation of the provider peer grouping system, which will become a common community source of information that can be a building block for more fundamental payment reforms. But that is built on another foundation, which is an all-payer claims database that the state has developed. And currently its uses are limited to provider peer grouping, but I just wanted to get on the table that it is potentially tremendously useful for a lot of other kinds of evaluations of reform. There are a bunch of people, so Meg and Charlie and Doug Wood all were parts of the advisory groups that MDH had on the peer grouping methodology, and those groups stated pretty strongly that that the legislature should consider allowing the expansion of that community database to other purposes, because it is really a public good that the state is invested in. And there are potentially many valuable other uses for it.
Dr. Jacobs.
I don't know that I can add to this great list of ideas that are out there. In the safety net practice that we have at Hennepin, we're doing many of these things. But I think it's important to point out that there's not exactly a level playing field between our government payer programs and the commercial market right now. And one of the considerations that we need to have is the solutions may not work quite as well based upon the ability of those markets to support it. So, for example, we have a tremendous healthcare home model that preceded any of the discussions we've had at the table about healthcare homes in HIV care for some years. It keeps patients out of the hospital. It saved millions of dollars, reduced hospitalization 72%, funded by about $150 per member per month of Ryan White funds from the federal government. We're talking about per member per month rates in the dollars, not even necessarily tens of dollars. So there's going to be quite a discrepancy of the amount of care you can put in it. To move from the sublime to the ridiculous, in between we have healthcare homes in those levels, and at the bottom, we have kind of the current CCDS system where we're trying to cobble together at about 10 cents on the dollar what remains of general assistance medical care at a time when we have a 30% increase in uninsured and severely underinsured patients just this year alone. So I think the viability of these programs also have to be measured against the amount of the payment and not just the mechanisms of the payment reforms we're talking about.
Dr. Fazio.
Mr. Chair, just a general comment. As we think about payment reform, we're mostly talking about the supply side. But as a community, there are also some very interesting things going on the demand side. For instance, the local medical societies have started an initiative called Honoring Choices Minnesota. It's an attempt to replicate something that occurred in La Crosse in the late 90s and early 2000s, having to do with, as a community, making sure that everybody had a healthcare power of attorney and a living will, and that those things were available at the point where they accessed care and acknowledged and honored at the point where they accessed care. So that's going on in this community right now, as is a program that has come to be called Treatment Decision Support. So at the point where I enter care, whether it's because I might have a hysterectomy or because I have prostate cancer or I have breast cancer, do I know all the options that are available to me? Has it been very clear to me what the pros and cons of all my treatment options are? Because people seem to make very different choices given that information than when they're maybe not given all the information. So I think that helps us, too, from a community point of view with quality of life and quality of care and the demand for care, much of it very high-tech care.
Well, just on that, there is federal money available to set up regional centers for patient-based decision-making. And Senator Berglund is very interested in that, and we've asked the Milbank Foundation to help us maybe get one of those in Minnesota. I think there's like 10 nationally or something that are going to be authorized. But the end of life one is very can get controversial, I would say. But I'll just let that one go.
Well, and I understand in bringing it up that it's controversial. I'm not suggesting that we not do everything of life for people that they would like to have done. I simply think we make it clear. As long as the system's, you know, designed that way right now, it seems to be. But when people know what their options are, when people have had a conversation with somebody who knows how to have the conversation about what it is they would like done with them or for them, they sometimes make different choices than when they just leave themselves to the system.
I was going to one time have a bill that would have mandated for seniors when they get into the medical assistance program, they must be presented with that information, and I think that was in the Accountable Care Act as well. Got turned into a death panel, so it's not there anymore. Dan.
Mr. Chair, up in Duluth we run a very small pilot project called HealthShare that's a community coverage organization. A couple things we've learned so far that I think the group should take note of is, first of all, be aware of preconceived notions. Try to keep an open mind as we go through this process. We were told that in working with the very smallest businesses and insuring, or covering rather, folks who had been uninsured for a long time, that there would be a huge demand, pent-up demand, and in fact, that wasn't the case. So it's just kind of a useful thing to know. The other thing is I'm not hearing anybody talk about educating the consumers. We work very, very closely with our membership to educate them to become good consumers of healthcare. And we've been operating a year and a half. We have yet to have an inappropriate emergency visit. We have actually very few urgent care visits. And our costs are really quite low. So somewhere in the mix here, I think if you work hard with patients to educate them how the system works, and in our case, we have an awful lot of things that have to be pre-approved, but we make our member carry the paper and understand the process. And very often now they'll ask the questions, would physical therapy work a little better than an MRI or those kinds of things. So, it's something to consider in the process.
Hey, anything else? We're going to set up I think you have a list of when the Healthcare Access Commission is going to meet. And it's on the mornings of these days listed here. And
That's ours.
Yeah, I know. Okay. But the Healthcare Access Commission will meet from 9:30 to 12 on each one of those days. And
what?
Half of the days, okay. And so we've set up some times for this. And what I'm trying to do is I also would like to be on the exchange task force group. So this is going to be not at the same time as those in most cases. And what I think, we're going to have to come up with a recommendation. And I think we heard from a lot of people that are already doing many things and moving towards accountable care organizations and total cost of care and the baskets. And if you could email us just a one page or no more about what you're doing and where they're located, that would help. And we'll try to get a more defined agenda for our September 8th meeting.
Mr. Chairman,
be happy to take any comments. Yeah, Jim.
Well, and to that point, the reason we do with state things is that's where our money goes. And so it'd be interesting to see which of those things that we're doing in, Fairview or Medicare or whatever, that we can export into the state program, some of the county-based ideas. I've met with some of your Meeker County people about that we could export and systematize. And then the private market will adopt it as they choose. The self-insured, they do what they like anyway, and the small amount of, fully insured plans, we can always mess with them if we like, but just for sport sometimes, Dr. Fazio. but anyway, but so if there's ideas we can import into the state programs, be it Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance and whatever comes to the GAMC thing we've got going, that would be, actually there could be savings out of that, which might solve some the quality issues as well as some of the costs. So.
Anything else? Well, we'll meet then on September 8th, and I'll try to get an agenda out to you